It would have been easy for Sue and Eric to stop at this point, with the tables turned and the pursuer now pursued, the avoider now avoided. They could have simply exchanged roles, kept their prescribed distances, and maintained their comfort level. But Sue and Eric each had the courage to look deeper, and then to try, with the help of therapy and the support of an understanding and empathetic group, to risk really becoming closer as a couple, and with Tim as a family. There is no way to overstate how important initial encounters are for us all. As a therapist, the impact a new client has on me during our first meeting provides some of the most important information I will ever receive about that person. Through what is said and what is left unsaid, and by everything else that is revealed by physical appearance, posture, grooming, facial expression, mannerisms and gestures, tone of voice, eye contact or lack of it, attitude and style, I receive an abundance of information about how the client operates in the world, particularly under stress. It all adds up to getting a strong, undeniably subjective impression, providing me with an intuitive sense of what it is going to be like to work with this person in the therapeutic relationship. While, as a therapist, I very consciously try to assess my new client's approach to life, a very similar, though less deliberately conscious, process ensues when any two people meet. Each tries to answer some questions about the other, based on the wealth of information automatically telegraphed during those first few moments together. The questions being silently asked are usually simple. Are you someone with whom I have anything in common? Can I benefit in any way from cultivating a friendship with you? Are you fun to be with? But often other questions are asked, depending on who these two people are and what they want. For every woman who loves too much, stronger questions reside beneath the obvious, rational, practical ones. Questions we strive all the harder to answer because they come from so deep inside us. Do you need me? The woman who loves too much secretly asks. Will you take care of me and solve my problems? Is the silent query behind the spoken words of the man who would choose her to be his partner. Chapter 7. Beauty and the Beast. In the stories from the two previous chapters, the women uniformly expressed a need to be of service, to help the men with whom they became involved. Indeed, the opportunity to be of help to these men was the main ingredient in the attraction they felt. The men, correspondingly, indicated that they had been searching for someone who could help them, who could control their behavior, make them feel safe, or save them, who would be, in the words of one of my male clients, the woman in white. This theme of women redeeming men through the gift of their selfless, perfect, all-accepting love is not a modern idea by any means. Fairy tales, embodying as they do the most important lessons of the culture that creates and perpetuates them, have for centuries been offering versions of this drama. In Beauty and the Beast, a beautiful young innocent meets a repulsive and frightening monster. To save her family from his wrath, she agrees to live with him. By getting to know him, she eventually overcomes her natural loathing, and finally even grows to love him, in spite of his animal persona. When she does, of course, a miracle transpires, and he is freed of his beastly guise and restored to his true, not only human, but princely self. As the restored prince, he is a grateful and suitable partner for her. Thus, her love and acceptance of him are repaid 1,000-fold as she assumes her proper place by his side to share a life of blessed good fortune. Beauty and the Beast, like every fairy tale that has endured centuries of telling and retelling, embodies a profound spiritual truth in the context of a compelling story. Spiritual truths are very difficult to comprehend, and even more difficult to put into practice, because they often go against contemporary values. Accordingly, there is a tendency to interpret the fairy tale in a way that reinforces the cultural bias. By doing so, it is easy to miss its deeper meaning altogether. Later, we will explore the profound spiritual lesson that Beauty and the Beast holds for us. But first, we must look at the cultural bias this fairy tale seems to underscore, that a woman can change a man if she loves him enough. This belief, so powerful, so all-pervasive, permeates our individual and group psyches to the core. Reflected again and again in our daily speech and behavior is the tacit cultural assumption that we can change someone for the better through the force of our love, and that, if we are female, it is our duty to do so. When someone we care for is not acting or feeling the way we wish, we cast about for ways to try to change that person's behavior or mood, usually with the blessings of others who give us advice and encouragement in our efforts. Have you tried? The suggestions may be as contradictory as they are numerous, but few friends and relatives can resist making them. Everyone's focus is on how to help. Even the media gets into the act, not only reflecting this belief system, but also, with its influence, reinforcing and perpetuating it while continuing to delegate the job to women. For instance, women's magazines, as well as certain general interest publications, seem always to be publishing how to help your man become ... articles, while corresponding how to help your woman become ... articles are virtually non-existent in equivalent magazines for men. And we women buy the magazines and try to follow their advice, hoping to help the man in our life become what we want and need him to be. Why does the idea of changing someone unhappy or unhealthy, or worse, into our perfect partner, appeal to us women so deeply? Why is it so alluring, so enduring a concept? To some, the answer would seem obvious. Embodied in the Judeo-Christian ethic is the concept of helping those who are less fortunate than ourselves. We are taught that it is our duty to respond with compassion and generosity when someone has a problem, not to judge, but rather to help. This seems to be our moral obligation. Unfortunately, these virtuous motives by no means entirely explain the behavior of millions of women who choose to take as partners men who are cruel, indifferent, abusive, emotionally unavailable, addictive, or otherwise unable to be loving and caring. Women who love too much make these choices out of a driving need to control those closest to them. That need to control others originates in a childhood during which many overwhelming emotions are frequently experienced: fear, anger, unbearable tension, guilt, shame, pity for others, and for self. A child growing up in such an environment would be racked by these emotions to the point of being unable to function unless she developed ways to protect herself. Always, her tools for self-protection include a powerful defense mechanism, denial, and an equally powerful subconscious motivation, control. All of us unconsciously employ defense mechanisms such as denial throughout our lives, sometimes about rather trivial matters, and at other times about major issues and events. Otherwise, we would have to face facts about who we are and what we think and feel that do not fit with our idealized image of ourselves and our circumstances. The mechanism of denial is particularly useful in ignoring information with which we do not want to deal. For instance, not noticing, denying, how grown up a child is becoming can be a way of avoiding feelings about that child's leaving home. Or not seeing and feeling, denying, the gain of extra pounds that the mirror and tight clothing both reflect can allow our continued indulgence in favorite foods. Denial can be defined as a refusal to acknowledge reality on two levels, at the level of what is actually happening and at the level of feeling. Let's look at how denial helps to prepare a little girl to grow up and become a woman who loves too much. As a child, she may, for instance, have a parent who is rarely at home at night because of extramarital affairs. As she tells herself, or is told by other family members, that he is busy at work, she denies that there is any problem between her parents or that anything abnormal is happening. This prevents her from feeling fear for her family's stability and her own welfare. She also tells herself that he is working hard, which arouses compassion rather than the anger and shame that would be felt if reality were faced. Thus, she denies both reality and her feelings about that reality, and she creates a fantasy that is easier to live with. With practice, she becomes very skilled at protecting herself from pain in this way. But at the same time, she loses the ability to make a free choice about what she is doing. Her denial operates automatically, unbidden. In a dysfunctional family, there is always a shared denial of reality. No matter how serious the problems are, the family does not become dysfunctional unless there is denial operating. Further, should any family member attempt to break through this denial by, for instance, describing the family situation in accurate terms, the rest of the family will usually strongly resist that perception. Often, ridicule will be used to bring that person back into line, or failing that, the renegade family member will be excluded from the circle of acceptance, affection, and activity. No one using the defense mechanism of denial makes a conscious choice to tune out reality, to wear blinders in order to stop registering accurately what others are saying and doing. Nor does anyone in whom denial is operating decide not to feel her own emotions. It all just happens, as the ego, in its struggle to provide protection from overwhelming conflicts, burdens, and fears, cancels out information and input that is too troublesome. Perhaps a child whose parents frequently quarrel invites a friend to spend the night. During her friend's visit, both girls are awakened late at night by the parents' loud arguing. The visitor whispers, "Gee, your parents sure are noisy. Why are they yelling like that?" The embarrassed daughter, who has lain awake through many such quarrels, answers vaguely, "I don't know," and then lies there in agonized self-consciousness while the shouting continues. The young guest has no idea why her friend begins to avoid her soon thereafter. The guest is shunned because she was witness to her friend's family secret, and thus serves as a reminder of what her friend would rather deny. Embarrassing events, such as the parents' fight during that visit, are so painful that the daughter is much more comfortable denying the truth, and so ever more assiduously avoids whatever and whomever may threaten to dismantle her defense against pain. She does not want to feel her shame, her fear, her anger, helplessness, panic, despair, pity, resentment, disgust. But because these strong and conflicting emotions are what she would have to contend with if she let herself feel anything, she prefers not to feel at all. This is the source of her need to control the people and events in her life. Through controlling what goes on around her, she tries to create for herself a sense of safety. No shocks, no surprises, no feelings. Anyone in an uncomfortable situation seeks control of it, to whatever degree is possible. This natural reaction becomes exaggerated in members of an unhealthy family because there is so much pain. Remember Lisa's story, when her parents pressured her to get better grades in school. There was some realistic hope that schoolwork could be improved, but little chance that the mother's drinking behavior could be changed. So rather than face the devastating implications of their impotence regarding the mother's alcoholism, they chose to believe that family life would improve if and when Lisa did better in school. Lisa, too, remember, kept trying to improve, control, the situation by being good. Her good behavior was not in any way a wholesome expression of her delight with her family and with being alive. Quite the opposite. Each chore she performed, unasked, represented a desperate attempt to rectify the family's unbearable circumstances, for which she, as a child, felt responsible. Children inevitably carry the guilt and blame for serious problems that affect their families. This is because, through their fantasy of omnipotence, they believe both that they are the cause of the family's circumstances and that they have the power to change them, for better or worse. Like Lisa, Many unfortunate children are actively blamed by parents or others in the family for problems over which the children have no control. But even without the verbal blame of others, a child will assume a large portion of the responsibility for his or her family's troubles. It is not easy or comfortable for us to consider that selfless behavior, being good, and efforts to help may actually be attempts to control and not be altruistically motivated. I saw this dynamic simply and succinctly represented by the sign on an office door in an agency where I once worked. Shown was a two-toned circle, the top half of which was a bright yellow rising sun, and the bottom half of which was painted black. The sign read, "Help is the sunny side of control." It served to remind us counselors, as well as our clients, to constantly examine the motives behind our need to change others. When efforts to help are practiced by people who come from unhappy backgrounds, or who are in stressful relationships in the present, the need to control must always be suspected. When we do for another what he can do for himself, when we plan another's future or daily activities, when we prompt, advise, remind, warn, or cajole another person who is not a young child, when we cannot bear for him to face the consequences of his actions, so we either try to change his actions or avert their consequences, this is controlling. Our hope is that if we can control him, then we can control our own feelings where our life touches his. And of course, the harder we try to control him, the less we are able to. But we cannot stop. A woman who habitually practices denial and control will be drawn into situations demanding those traits. Denial, by keeping her out of touch with the reality of her circumstances, and her feelings about those circumstances will lead her into relationships fraught with difficulty. She will then employ all her skills at helping/controlling in order to make the situation more tolerable, all the while denying how bad it really is. Denial feeds the need to control, and the inevitable failure to control feeds the need to deny. This dynamic is illustrated in the following stories. These women have gained a good deal of insight into their behaviors through involvement with therapy and, when appropriate, because of the nature of their problems, involvement in other support groups as well. They have been able to recognize their helping behavior for what it was, a subconsciously motivated attempt to deny their own pain by controlling those closest to them. The intensity of each woman's desire to be of help to her partner is a clue that it was much more a need than a choice. Connie, 32, divorced, with an 11-year-old son. Before therapy, I could not remember a single issue that my parents fought about. All I could remember was that they constantly fought. Every day, every meal, almost every minute. They criticized each other, disagreed with each other, and insulted each other, while my brother and I looked on. Dad would stay away at work, or wherever, as much as he could. But sooner or later, he'd have to come home, and then it would begin again. My role in all of this was, first of all, to pretend nothing was wrong, and second, to try and distract either one or both of them by being entertaining. I would toss my head and beam them a big smile and make a joke or do whatever silly thing I could think of to capture their attention. Actually, I was scared to death inside, but being afraid got in the way of putting on a good show. So I clowned and joked, and soon it became a full-time job, being cute. I got so much practice when I was at home that after a while, I started acting like that elsewhere, too. I was always polishing my act. Basically, it came down to this. If anything was wrong, I ignored it, and at the same time I tried to cover it up. That last sentence encapsulizes what happened in my marriage. I met Kenneth by the pool at my apartment when I was 20. He was very tan, very good-looking, in a sunburned surfer sort of way. The fact that he was interested enough to want to live with me shortly after we met made me feel that we had a lot going for us. Also, he was pretty cheerful, like me, so I thought we had all the ingredients for being happy together. Kenneth was a little vague, a little indecisive about his career, about what he wanted to do with his life, and I gave him lots of encouragement there. I was sure I was helping him blossom, giving him needed support and direction. I made virtually all the decisions concerning us as a couple, too, right from the beginning. But still, somehow, he did just as he wanted. I felt strong, and he felt free to lean on me. It was just what we each needed, I guess. We had been living together for 3 or 4 months when an old girlfriend of his from work called him at home. She was very surprised to hear that I was living with Kenneth. She told me that he'd never mentioned to her that he was involved with anyone else, even though he saw her at least 2 or 3 times a week at work. All this came out when she was stumbling around trying to apologize for calling. Well, that shook me a little, and I asked Kenneth about it. He told me he hadn't thought it was important to tell her. I remember the fear and the pain I felt then, but I felt that way only for a moment. Then I cut off those feelings and became very intellectual about it. I saw only 2 choices. I could either fight with him about it, or else let it drop and not expect him to see things the way I did. I chose the latter, hands down, and made a joke of the whole thing. I had promised myself that I would never, ever fight the way my parents had. In fact, the thought of getting angry literally nauseated me, because I had been so busy as a child entertaining everyone and didn't dare feel any strong emotions. By now, powerful feelings really frightened me. They knocked me off balance. Besides, I liked to keep things smooth. So I accepted what Kenneth said and buried my doubts about how sincerely he was committed to me. We got married a few months later. Fast forward 12 years, when one day, at the suggestion of a friend at work, I found myself in the office of a therapist. I thought I was still in total control of my life, but my friend had said she was worried about me and insisted that I see someone for help. Kenneth and I had been married for those 12 years, and I thought we had been very happy. But now we were separated at my suggestion. The therapist probed. What had gone wrong? I talked about lots of different things, and in the midst of my ramblings mentioned that he had been leaving the house in the evening, at first once or twice a week, then 3 or 4 times a week, and finally, for the past 5 years or so, 6 out of 7 nights. Finally, I had said to him that it looked as if he really wanted to be elsewhere, so maybe he'd better move out. The therapist asked me if I knew where he had been all those nights, and I told her I didn't know, that I'd never asked him. I remember how surprised she looked. All those nights over all those years, and you never asked? I told her, no, never. That I thought married couples had to give each other space. What I would do, though, was to talk to him about how he should spend more time with our son, Thad. He always agreed with me, and then would go off the same way in the evenings, maybe joining us to do something together on a Sunday, now and then. I chose to see him as someone who wasn't very bright, who needed those endless lectures from me to keep him somewhat on track as a good father. I never could admit to myself that he was doing exactly what he wanted to do, and that I was helpless to change him. Actually, it got worse and worse over the years, in spite of how perfectly I tried to behave. The therapist asked me during that first session what I thought he'd been doing during the hours he was not at home. I got annoyed. I just didn't want to think about it, because if I didn't, then it couldn't hurt me. I know now that Kenneth was incapable of being with just one woman, though he liked the security of an ongoing relationship. He had given me 1,000 clues about his behavior, both before marriage and after, at company picnics when he would disappear for hours, or at parties when he'd start talking to some woman and then they'd go off together. Without even thinking about what I was doing in those situations, I'd turn on the charm to distract people from what was happening, and to show what a great sport I was, and maybe to prove that I was lovable, not someone a boyfriend or husband would want to get away from if he could. It took me a long time in therapy to be able to remember that other women had been the problem with my parents' marriage, too. Their fights had been about my father going off and not coming home, and my mother, while not saying it outright, would hint that he was unfaithful and then berate him for neglecting all of us. I thought that she drove him away, and decided very consciously that I would never behave the way she did. So I held it all in, and worked on, always smiling. That's what brought me to therapy. I was still smiling and sunny the day after my 9-year-old son made a suicide attempt. I passed it off as a joke, which really alarmed my friend at work. I had held this magical belief for so long that if I were nice and never got angry, everything would work out fine. Seeing Kenneth as not too bright helped too. I got to lecture and to try to organize his life, which was for him probably a small price to pay to have someone cook and clean while he did exactly what he wanted, no questions asked. The depth of my denial that anything was wrong was so great that I couldn't let go of it until I got help. My son was terribly unhappy, and I simply would not let that register. I tried to talk him out of it, made jokes about it, which probably made him feel worse. I also refused to acknowledge that anything was wrong to anyone who knew us. Kenneth was out of the house for 6 months, and I still didn't tell anyone we were separated, which also made it hard for my son. He had to keep the secret, too, and hide his hurt about all of it as well. I didn't want to talk to anyone about it, so I wouldn't let him either. I didn't see how desperately he needed to let out the secret. The therapist really pushed me to start telling people that my perfect marriage was over. Oh, was it hard for me to admit that. I think Thad's suicide attempt was simply his way of saying, "Hey, everybody, something is wrong." Well, we're doing better now. Thad and I are still in therapy together and separately, learning how to talk to each other and feel what we're feeling. There's been a rule in my therapy that I can't make a joke out of anything that comes up during the hour. It's very hard for me to let go of that defense and feel what happens to me when I do, but I'm lots better at it. When I go on dates, I sometimes have thoughts about how this man or that needs me to straighten some little details of his life for him. But I know better than to indulge in that kind of thinking for long. Very occasional snipes at those sick little urges to help are the only cracks I'm allowed to make in therapy these days. It feels good, laughing about how sick that behavior has been, rather than laughing to cover up everything that's been wrong. Connie first used humor to distract herself and her parents from the threatening reality of their unstable relationship. By employing all her charm and wit, she could draw their attention away from each other to her, and thus stop their fighting, at least temporarily. Each time this occurred, she would experience herself as the glue holding these two combatants together, with all the responsibility that role implied. These interactions spawned her need to control others in order to feel safe and secure herself, and she exercised her control by distracting with humor. She learned to be extremely sensitive to signs of anger and hostility in those around her, and to avert any such expression with a well-timed quip or a disarming smile. She had double cause to deny her own feelings. First, the thought of her parents' potential breakup was too frightening to bear, and second, any emotions of her own would only hamper her delivery of a good performance. Soon, she was denying her feelings automatically, just as she was seeking to manipulate and control those around her automatically. Her shallow effervescence undoubtedly alienated some people, but others, like Kenneth, who had no desire to relate on anything but a most superficial level, were attracted to that style. That Connie could live for years with a man who would leave for hours at a time, with increasing frequency, and who finally began disappearing nightly, and never questioned him about his activities or whereabouts during those absences, is a measure of her great capacity for denial and the commensurate fear behind it. Connie didn't want to know, didn't want to fight or confront, and most of all, didn't want to feel the old childhood terror that through dissension, her entire world would fall apart. It was very difficult to get Connie to make a commitment to a therapeutic process that demanded she relinquish her chief defense, humor. It was as though someone were asking her to give up breathing air. At some level, she was sure she would not survive without it. Her son's desperate plea that they both begin to face the painful reality of their situation barely penetrated Connie's massive defenses. She was out of touch with reality, very nearly to the point of being truly crazy. And for a long time in therapy, insisted on talking about only Thad's problems, denying she had any of her own. Always the strong one, she wasn't about to give up that position without a fight. But slowly, as she became more willing to experience the panic that surfaced when she didn't resort to joking, she began to feel safer. Connie learned that she had at her disposal, as an adult, far healthier coping mechanisms than those she had so overused from childhood. She began to question, to confront, to express herself, and make her needs known. She learned to be more honest than she had been in many, many years, with herself and with others. And she finally was able to reclaim her humor, which now included healthy laughter at herself. Pam, 36, twice divorced, mother of two teenage sons. I grew up in a tense, unhappy home. My father had deserted my mother before I was born, and she became what seemed to me the original single parent. No one else I knew had divorced parents, and living where we did, in a very middle-class town in the 50s, we were made to feel like the oddity we were. I worked hard in school and was a very pretty child, so teachers liked me. This helped a lot. At least academically, I could succeed. I became a real overachiever, getting straight A's all through grammar school. In junior high, the emotional pressure began to build so much that I couldn't really concentrate anymore, so my grades began to slip, although I never dared to do badly. I always had the feeling that my mother was disappointed in me and afraid that I would embarrass her. My mother worked hard as a secretary to support us, and I realize now she was exhausted all the time. She also had a great deal of pride, and deep shame, I think, about being divorced. She was very uncomfortable when other children would come to our house. We were poor, struggling to make ends meet, and yet we had this terrific need to keep up appearances. Well, it was easier to do that if people never saw where we lived, so our house was not a welcoming place, to say the least. When friends would ask me to spend the night with them, my mother would tell me, "They don't really want you." She did that partly because she didn't want to have to reciprocate and have them stay at our house. But of course, I didn't know that when I was young. I believed what she told me, that I wasn't someone people wanted to be around. I grew up believing there was something very wrong with me. I wasn't sure what it was, but it had to do with being unacceptable and unlovable. There was no love in our home, just duty. The worst part of it was that we could never talk about the lie we were living, trying when we were out in the world to look better than we were, happier, wealthier, more successful. The pressure to do so was intense, but it was virtually unspoken, and I never felt I could even bring it off. I was so afraid that any moment it would become apparent that I just wasn't as good as everybody else. While I knew how to dress nicely and perform scholastically, I always felt like a fraud. Underneath, I knew I was flawed to the very core. If people liked me, it was because I was fooling them. If they knew me well, they would go away. Growing up without a father made it worse, I suppose, because I never learned how to relate to males in a give-and-take way. They were exotic animals, forbidding and fascinating at the same time. My mother never told me much about my father, but the little she said made me feel he wasn't anything to be proud of, so I didn't ask questions. I was afraid of what I might learn. She didn't like men much at all, and hinted that basically they were dangerous, selfish, and not to be trusted. But I couldn't help it. I found them all fascinating, starting with the little boys in kindergarten my first day of school. I was looking hard for what was missing in my life, but I didn't know what it was. I guess it was that I so badly wanted to be close to somebody, to give and receive affection. I knew that men and women, husbands and wives, were supposed to love each other, but my mother was telling me in subtle and not so subtle ways that men didn't make you happy, they made you miserable, and they did that by leaving you, running off with your best friend, or by betraying you in some other way. Those were the kinds of stories I heard from her when I was growing up. I probably decided very early that I would find myself someone who wouldn't, couldn't go away. Maybe someone nobody else would want. Then I guess I forgot that I'd ever made such a decision. I just kept on acting it out. I could never have put it into words when I was growing up, but the only way I knew how to be with someone, especially someone male, was if he needed me. Then he wouldn't leave me because I'd be helping him and he'd be grateful. Not surprisingly, my first boyfriend was disabled. He had been in a car accident and his back had been broken. He wore leg braces and used steel crutches to walk. I used to pray at night that God would make me the one who couldn't walk instead of him. We would go to dances together and I would sit by him all night long. Now he was a nice enough boy, and certainly a girl could have enjoyed being with him just for his company. But I had another reason. I was with him because it was safe. Since I was doing him a favor, I wouldn't be rejected and get hurt. It was like having an insurance policy against pain. I was really crazy about this boy, but I know now that I chose him because, like me, he had something wrong with him. His flaw showed, so I could be comfortable feeling all this pain and pity for him. He was by far my healthiest boyfriend. After him came juvenile delinquents, underachievers, losers, all of them. When I was 17, I met my first husband. He was in trouble in school and flunking out. His father and mother were divorced but still fighting with each other. Compared to his background, mine looked good. I could relax a little, not feel so ashamed. And of course, I felt so sorry for him. He was quite a rebel, but I thought that was because no one before me had ever really understood him. Also, I had at least 20 IQ points over him. And I needed that edge. It took all that and more to make me even begin to believe I was his equal, and that he wouldn't leave me for someone better. My whole relationship with him, and we were married 12 years, was one of refusing to accept who he was, and instead trying to make him into what I thought he ought to be. I was sure he would be so much happier and feel so much better about himself if he would just allow me to show him how to parent our children, how to run his business, how to relate to his family. I had continued going to school, majoring, naturally, in psychology. My own life was so out of control, so miserable, and there I was, studying how to take care of everyone else. To be fair to myself, I really was looking hard for answers, but I thought that the key to my happiness was to get him to change. He obviously needed my help. He wasn't paying his bills or his taxes. He made the children and me promises he didn't keep. He infuriated his customers who would call me to complain about how he hadn't followed through on jobs he had started for them. I wasn't able to leave him until I could finally see who he really was, instead of who I wanted him to be. I spent the last 3 months of the marriage just watching, not giving those interminable lectures of mine, but just keeping quiet and watching. That's when I realized I could not live with who he was. All along, I'd been waiting to be able to love the wonderful man that I thought, with my help, he could become. Only my hope that he'd change for me kept me going all those years. It still wasn't clear to me, though, that I had a pattern of picking men who were not, in my opinion, fine, just as they were, but rather whom I saw as needing my help. I only caught on to that after several more relationships with impossible men. One was addicted to pot, one was gay, one was impotent, and one, with whom I finally had a long relationship, was supposedly very unhappily married. When that involvement ended, disastrously, I couldn't continue to believe it was all bad luck. I knew I must have had a part in what had happened to me. By this time, I was a licensed psychologist, and my whole life revolved around helping people. I know now that my field is full of people like me, who help others all day long at work, and still feel the need to help in their personal relationships too. My entire method of relating to my sons was to remind them, encourage them, coach them, and worry about them. That was all I knew about loving, to try to help people and to be concerned about them. I hadn't the slightest clue how to accept others as they were, probably because I had never accepted myself. Life did me a real favor at this point. Everything fell apart for me. When my affair with the married man ended, my boys were both in trouble with the law, and my health was completely shot. I just couldn't keep on taking care of everyone else. It was my son's probation officer who told me I'd better start working on taking care of myself. And I was somehow able to hear him. After all those years in psychology, he was the one who finally got through to me. It took having my whole life fall down around my ears to make me look at myself and the depth of my own self-hatred. One of the hardest things I had to face was that my mother really hadn't wanted the responsibility of raising me. Hadn't wanted me, period. I can understand now as an adult how hard it must have been for her. But all those messages she gave me about other people not wanting me around, she was really describing herself. And as a child, I knew it at some level, but I couldn't face it, I guess. So I ignored it. Pretty soon I ignored a lot. I didn't let myself hear the criticisms she constantly threw at me, or how angry she got if I had fun. It was too threatening to let myself experience all the hostility she directed toward me, so I stopped feeling, I stopped responding, and I poured all my energy into being good and helping others. As long as I was working on everybody else, I never had time to pay attention to myself, to feel my own pain. It was hard on my pride, but I got into a self-help group made up of women who had similar problems with men. The group was the kind I would usually be leading professionally, and there I was, just a humble participant. Though my ego took a beating, this group helped me look at my need to manage and control others, and helped me to stop doing it. I began to heal inside. Instead of working on everybody else, I finally was taking care of myself, and there was so much work to do. Once I began concentrating on trying to let go of fixing everyone in my life, I practically had to stop talking. Everything I had said for so long had been helpful. It was a terrific shock to me to hear how much managing and controlling I was doing. Altering my behavior has caused even my professional work to change radically. I'm much more able to be with clients in a supportive way while they work out their problems. Before, I felt this huge responsibility to fix them. Now it's more important that I understand them. Some time passed, and then a nice man came along. He didn't need me at all. There was really nothing wrong with him. I was very uncomfortable at first, learning how to be with him, instead of trying to make him over completely. After all, that had been my whole way of relating to people, but I learned not to do anything except just be myself. And it seems to be working. I feel as if my life has just begun to make some sense, and I keep going to my group to keep from slipping back into my old ways. Sometimes, everything in me still wants to run the show, but I know better than to give in to that need anymore. How does all this relate to denial and control? Pam began by denying the reality of her mother's anger and hostility toward her. She didn't allow herself to feel what it meant to be an unwelcome object rather than a beloved child in her family. She didn't allow herself to feel, period, because it hurt too much. Later, this inability to perceive and experience her emotions actually would enable her to become involved with the men she chose. Her emotional warning system, which would otherwise steer her away from them, was inoperative at the beginning of each relationship, due to highly developed denial. Because she couldn't feel what it was like, emotionally, to be with these men, she could perceive them only as needing her understanding and her help. Pam's pattern of developing relationships in which her role was to understand, encourage, and improve her partner is a formula often employed by women who love too much, and it usually yields exactly the opposite of the hoped-for result. Rather than a grateful, loyal partner who is bonded to her through his devotion and his dependence, such a woman finds she soon has a man who is increasingly rebellious, resentful, and critical of her. Out of his own need to maintain his autonomy and self-respect, he must cease to see her as the solution to all his problems, and make her instead the source of many, if not most of them. When this happens and the relationship crumbles, the woman is plunged into a deeper sense of failure and despair. If she cannot even make someone so needy and inadequate love her, how could she ever hope to earn and keep the love of a healthier, more appropriate man? This explains why often such women follow one bad relationship with another that is even worse, because they feel increasingly less worthy with each such failure. It also makes clear how difficult it will be for such a woman to break this pattern, unless she gains an understanding of the basic need that drives her. Pam, like many others in the helping professions, used her career to bolster her fragile sense of worth. She could relate only to neediness in others, including her clients, children, husbands, and other partners. In every area of her life, she sought ways to avoid feeling her deep sense of inadequacy and inferiority. Not until Pam began to experience the powerful healing properties of understanding and acceptance that she got from peers in her group did her self-esteem grow so that she could begin to relate in a healthy way to others, including a healthy man. Celeste, 45, divorced, mother of three children, who live with their father abroad. I've probably been with more than 100 men in my life, and I'll bet, looking back, that every one of them was either too many years younger than I, or a con artist, or dependent on drugs or alcohol, or gay, or crazy. 100 impossible men. How did I find them all? My father was a chaplain in the army. That meant that he pretended to be a kind, loving man everywhere but at home, where he didn't bother to be anything but what he was. Mean, demanding, critical, and selfish. He and my mother both believed that we children existed to help him carry off his professional charade. We were supposed to look perfect by getting straight A's, being social charmers, and never getting into trouble. Given the atmosphere at home, this was impossible. You could cut the tension with a knife any time my father was in the house. He and my mother were not close at all. She was furious all the time. Not loudly fighting with him, just quietly, grimly seething. Whenever my father did anything she asked him to, he screwed it up on purpose. Once, there was something wrong with the front door, and he fixed it with these nails, great big nails, which ruined the whole thing. We all learned to leave him alone. After retirement, he was home every day and every night, sitting in his chair, glowering. He didn't say much, but just his being there made life difficult for all of us. I really hated him. I couldn't see then that he had problems of his own, or that we did too, in the way we reacted to him, and let him control us by his presence. It was a continuing contest, who would control whom? And he always won, passively. Anyway, I had long since developed into the rebel in the family. I was angry, just like my mother, and the only way I could express it was to reject all the values my parents embodied, to get out and try to be the opposite of everything and everyone in my family. I think it was the fact that we looked so normal from the outside that infuriated me the most. I wanted to scream from rooftops how awful our family was, but no one else seemed to notice. My mother and sisters were willing to have me be the one with the problem, and I obliged by playing my part to the hilt. I started an underground newspaper at the base high school, which stirred up a lot of trouble. Then I went away to college, and as soon as I had the chance, I left the country. I couldn't get far enough away from home to satisfy me. I was outwardly very rebellious, but inside there was nothing but confusion. My first sexual experience occurred when I was abroad in Europe, and it was not with another American. It was with a young African student. He was eager to learn about the States, and I felt like his mentor, stronger, wiser, more worldly. The fact that I was white and he was black caused a lot of waves. I didn't care. It reinforced my view of myself as a rebel. A few years later, still in college, I met and married a Britisher. He was an intellectual from a wealthy family. I respected that. He was also 27 and still a virgin. Again, I was the teacher, which made me feel strong and independent, and in control. We were married 7 years, living abroad, and I was terribly restless and unhappy, but I didn't know why. Then I met a young orphan student and began a really tempestuous affair with him, during which I left my husband and 2 children. This young man had been involved sexually only with men until he met me. We lived together for 2 years in my apartment. He had male lovers as well, but I didn't care. We tried all kinds of things sexually, broke all the rules. It was an adventure for me. But after a while I got restless again, and eased him out of my life as a lover, though we're still friends today. After him came a long series of involvements with some real low-life types. They all, at the very least, moved in with me. Most of them also borrowed money from me, sometimes thousands of dollars, and a couple of them drew me into some very illegal schemes. I had no idea that I had a problem, even with all this going on. Since each of these men was getting something from me, I felt like the strong one, the one in charge of things. Then I came back to the States and got involved with a man who was probably the worst of the lot. He was so alcoholic that he suffered brain damage. He was easily roused to violence, he rarely bathed, didn't work, and was facing jail time for offenses related to his drinking. I went with him to the agency where he attended a program for convicted drunk drivers, and the instructor there suggested that I see one of their counselors, because it was apparent that I was also having problems. It was apparent to the drunk driving class instructor, but not to me. I thought it was this man I was with who had all the problems and that I was fine. But I did go to a counseling session, and right away this woman got me talking about how I related to men. I'd never looked at my life from that angle before. I decided to continue to see her, and that's when I was helped to begin to see the pattern I'd created. I had shut off so much feeling as a child that I required all the drama these men provided, just to feel alive. Trouble with the police, involvement with drugs, financial schemes, dangerous people, crazy sex. These had all become the ordinary stuff of life to me. In fact, even with all of that, I still couldn't feel anything much. I stayed with the counseling and began to go to a women's group at the counselor's suggestion. There I slowly began to learn some things about myself, about my attraction to unhealthy or inadequate men, whom I could dominate through my efforts to help them. Even though I'd been in analysis in England for years and years, endlessly talking about my hatred for my father and my anger at my mother, I had never related it to my obsession with impossible men. Although I'd always thought analysis benefited me immensely, it had never helped me change my patterns. In fact, when I examine my behavior, I see I only got worse over those years. Now, in counseling and group, as I'm beginning to get better, my relationships with men are getting a little healthier, too. A while back, I got involved with a diabetic who wouldn't take his insulin, and I was in there trying to help him with lectures about the danger of what he was doing and with attempts to improve his self-esteem. It may sound funny, but my involvement with him was a step up. At least he wasn't a full-on addict. Still, I was practicing my familiar role as the strong woman in charge of a man's welfare. I'm leaving men alone for a while because I finally realized that I really don't want to take care of a man, and that's still the only way I know how to relate to them. They've just been my way of avoiding taking care of myself. I'm working on learning to love myself, to take care of me for a change, and to let go of all these distractions, because that's what men have been in my life. It's scary, though, because I was much better at taking care of them than I am at caring for myself. Again, we see the twin themes of denial and control. Celeste's family was an emotional chaos, but that chaos was never openly acknowledged or expressed. Even her rebellion against the family's rules and norms only subtly hinted at the family's deeply troubled core. She was shouting, but none of them would listen. In her frustration and isolation, she turned off all her feelings save one, anger, at her father for not being there for her, and at the rest of the family for refusing to acknowledge their problems or her pain. But her anger was free-floating. She did not understand that it stemmed from her helplessness to change the family she loved and needed. She could not get any of her emotional needs for love and security met in this milieu, so she sought relationships that she could control, with others who were not as educated or experienced, not as well off financially or well set socially as herself. How deep her need for this pattern of relating became is revealed by the extreme inadequacy of her last partner, a late-stage alcoholic, who came very close to fitting the stereotype of the Skid Row bum. And still, Celeste, bright, sophisticated, educated, and worldly, missed all the cues as to how very sick and inappropriate this liaison was. Her denial of her own feelings and perceptions, and her need to control the man and the relationship, far outweighed her intelligence. A major part of Celeste's recovery involved her letting go of her intellectual analysis of herself and her life, and beginning to feel the deep emotional pain that accompanied the tremendous isolation she had always endured. Her numerous and exotic sexual involvements were only possible because she felt so little connection with other human beings and with her own body. Indeed, these involvements actually prevented her from having to risk real closeness with others. The drama and excitement substituted for the threatening intensity of intimacy. Recovery meant holding still with herself, without a man to sidetrack her, and feeling her feelings, including the painful isolation. It also meant having other women who understood her behavior and feelings validate her efforts to change. For Celeste, recovery requires learning to relate to and trust other women, as well as relating to and trusting herself. Celeste must develop a relationship with herself before she can relate in a healthy way with a man, and she still has some hard work to do in that area. Basically, all her encounters with men were merely reflections of the anger, chaos, and rebellion within her, and her attempts to control those men were also attempts to subdue the inner forces and feelings that drove her. Her work is with herself, and as she gains more inner stability, this will be reflected in her interactions with men. Until she learns to love and trust herself, she will not be able to experience either loving or trusting a man, or being loved and trusted by him. Many women make the mistake of looking for a man with whom to develop a relationship without first developing a relationship with themselves. They run from man to man, looking for what is missing within. The search must begin at home, within the self. No one can ever love us enough to fulfill us if we do not love ourselves. Because when in our emptiness we go looking for love, we can only find more emptiness. What we manifest in our lives is a reflection of what is deep inside us, our beliefs about our own worth, our right to happiness, what we deserve in life. When those beliefs change, so does our life. Janice, 38, married, mother of three teenage sons. Sometimes, when you've worked so hard to keep up appearances on the outside, it's practically impossible to show anybody what's really going on inside. It's hard to even know yourself. For years and years, I'd been hiding what went on at home while putting on a great show out there in public. I began, early as a child in school, taking responsibility, running for office, being in charge. It felt wonderful. Sometimes I think I could have stayed in high school forever. There I was, somebody who could succeed. I was homecoming queen, captain of the drill team, and senior class vice president. Robbie and I were even voted cutest couple for the yearbook. Everything looked so good. At home, it looked good, too. My dad was a salesman and made lots of money. We had a nice big house with a pool and just about everything we wanted in the way of material things. What was missing was all on the inside, where it didn't show. My dad was on the road nearly all the time. He loved staying in motels, picking women up in bars. Whenever he was home with my mom, they would get into terrible